This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Richard Davies, UK Country Managing Partner from Netcompany. And we're going to talk about the importance of your underlying data framework when it comes to building your next set of application platforms. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Do you want to tell us a bit about you and Netcompany?
Yeah, I'd love to say a quick few words about Netcompany, Ian. It's an international IT services business. It's been at the forefront of helping companies, both in the public and private space, transform the way that they deliver products and services. I've got the pleasure of heading it up in the UK, and we're probably best known for the recent delivery of COVID Pass, which was a technically challenging project in very challenging circumstances as we were trying to, along with the NHS and the government at large, reopen UK society. We're immensely proud of the work that we did to help enable that. And that obviously has opened up over 20 million users now of the NHS app. We're steeped in technical prowess. We have a saying, IT people leading IT people, which we believe to be fundamentally important because, as we're probably going to talk about in the rest of this podcast, you cannot do some of the transformational work that you need to do unless you understand deeply the technology and how it all fits together. It becomes extremely important that people working in these projects deeply understand the tech, but can also articulate why it's important to someone more senior that they do this, because not everyone loves tech.
Data frameworks. We tend to think we've got a lot of data in organizations. We've got large numbers of apps, large numbers of data servers that we've spent a fortune trying to integrate, but that doesn't necessarily make them fit for purpose when it comes to taking the business forward. Where do we start in trying to understand what makes a good data platform?
All of these things, Ian. It's a big question. Let me try and take it in chunks because I think most large enterprises wrestle with this issue. There is a lot of data, but a lot of it's locked away. A lot of it you can't get at. And sometimes you don't know why you want to get at it. Where it tends to, in our experience, start from is you just need a very common understanding of why you're doing things. And that will all start with the business process. And way too often, a lot of time and effort goes into definitions, requirements, and less about getting started. The clearer you can be on defining the business process up front, the faster you can then get into, well, what is the data we're going to need?
But how easy is it to define that initial business process up front? If we look at organizations, we've moved from a world of mainframes, mini computers, where we define processes absolutely, to a world now where with mobile applications and the agile frameworks that we're using, in many cases, those business processes are being written almost on the fly. How do we get that baked-in first start point?
It's a really interesting dichotomy that you raised there. There's been an explosion in applications across most firms and most industries, but you're still not unlocking that data that's hidden away in those legacy systems. And that's a real challenge, because if you're to create new ways of digitizing firms and industries, you have to address that legacy issue. You have to get at that data that's locked away, and you have to find a way of building new data platforms on top of that. Because you're not replacing those systems, you're not rolling your sleeves up and rewriting systems of record. That would be prohibitive, both from a financial standpoint and an engineering standpoint. But you certainly have to have a plan and a methodology for getting the right data or the data you need out of those systems of record.
But that makes an assumption that people know what is in those systems of record. It makes an assumption that they have some clarity on what data they're going to want to use. And rarely is it just about the systems of record. It's about all those other systems that sit around those that provide context that enable us to enrich that data. You made a statement just now about that data that's hidden, which for most people is that system of record. They know it's there, but it's just something that IT looks after. How do we expose that better so that people can begin to understand what they've got to begin with to help them shape the question as to where they want to go?
I can only speak from our own experiences. I mean, everyone's going to have a different approach, but for us, it starts with you create the right kind of discovery process around a particular business challenge, and you use that discovery process to open up that data. You then use that process to show something of value to whoever the owner or the ultimate recipient is going to be of that digitized service. There's no other way. Unfortunately, what tends to have happened in our industry is that most people have gone for a big bang approach and tried to completely re-engineer that system of record, which has led to obviously a lot of disappointment, both in delivering anything and also in terms of the prohibitive costs of doing such a thing. It's really important you have a good discovery process. It's really important you have an ability to create the right kind of alignment and scope with the people that matter within the organization. When I say the people that matter, what I really mean is those people are responsible ultimately for delivering that new service. And that's going to be people from all facets of the organization. It's the only way we've seen people successfully digitize their organizations and unlock that data that's hidden away. You can always, to a lesser or greater extent, provided you've built on standard technologies and provided your APIs are good, you can always plug in third-party products, off-the-shelf products, some of the products you may have written yourself. But without that underlying data that's been locked away, you're really not seeing the full picture. Given that most large organizations still fundamentally run a lot of their key operations off those systems of record and not some of the new things that have been created, it's something that everyone has to address in one way, shape or form.
You talk about those APIs. Data integration is nothing new. When I first came into this industry in the 1980s, we were beginning to do data integration. By the end of the 80s, early 90s, we were pulling stuff down off mainframes and minicomputers and putting it on PCs to actually work with. This is not a new challenge. Yet many of those integration points are rolled by the IT department. They're not bought in from outside. Where they have created APIs, they've created big, clumsy APIs that were fit for internal use and aren't necessarily agile and can be exposed to an outside world. How do we build that API fit for service that you just talked about?
It comes back to a discovery process. You have to understand why you're building something and for what purpose. And all too often in any organization, the loudest voice or group wins. But ultimately, you're digitizing your business processes because you are trying to do something better, whether it's for a customer, whether it's for a citizen or a consumer. That should really drive everything. The way in which we are now looking at building systems is you have to get the right APIs so people can write to them, build on them. You create those, I use the term ecosystems, but there's many words for it. But you want people to come and join your ecosystems and bring their great knowledge and skill with them. You can't do that if then the mechanism by which they join your club is a clunky, difficult system to interact with. It's hugely important, but again, it's dictated by the business purpose. And all too often, that's lost very quickly if you don't move from that discovery into implementation, because you're continuously learning.
How do we get flexibility into this? If we look at where we've done stuff around data, we've had integration points that we've used and we've created them on an app by app, integration by integration basis. Where it's been a larger set of integrations, we've tended to build a single monolithic object. But APIs don't work well in that sort of basis because they become insecure, they become difficult to manage, and the way we expose data to one group suddenly bleeds into other groups that perhaps need a much more restrictive thing. Are you seeing companies starting to look at not just where is my data, but looking at what APIs do I need for which block of data?
Absolutely right. The latter. What data are you exposing to whom and for what purpose? I could give you a real life example. We've just gone live in another country with a new airport management system. And as you may appreciate, airport management systems are actually terrifically complex things. They evolve over time. They have a great range of business needs, ranging from retail through to runways, through to airplane turnaround times. We've gone live with a few modules already where Copenhagen airports in this particular juncture have cancelled the rollout of their Amadeus system. The way that's been achieved has been whilst creating what I would call a central nervous system of data, you're only exposing the various business functions to the areas that they need that exposure and they need those APIs for. You're building everything in a microservices architecture, but you're very disciplined about who sees what. By doing that and by giving those various functions control over the questions they ask of that data, their ability to manipulate and their ability to ask meaningful insights or get meaningful insights by meaningful questions becomes far greater. But you have to go at it in that modularized approach. You cannot, in our experience, just open it up and say, there you go, that's for everybody. Knock yourself out, because you just get carnage. You also get into some more technical challenges, as any good architect will tell you, around all sorts of performance issues.
It raises a question over technical debt, doesn't it? Even with agile methodology, we still struggle with technical debt. But alongside technical debt, the one thing we don't talk enough about is security debt. If we're going to start to break these down into small APIs that link together, how much does that reduce the risk of both technical and security debt?
Agile without control is a difficult concept when you are trying to ultimately change very complex and in some cases aging systems. You can't just be agile. There has to be some controls written around that. Looking at your second question, if you're writing these things correctly and for the right purpose, then you will de-risk aspects of around that security side of things. But again, you have to include security as part and parcel of each micro project. You can't use this overarching one-size-fits-all approach to security or anything else for that matter.
One of the restrictions on our data, our integration points and our APIs has been the way we work with commercial off-the-shelf software, COTS. We're moving into a world now where you could arguably say that what was our prime focus, those COTS packages that we buy in bulk, are becoming less important to us because we need the flexibility that we don't get from them. How do companies start to transition? Because they've got to transition not only those rigid structures for data and integration that those packages required, but while they're transitioning, they're also transitioning into a new application world. What become the key challenges for them?
Biggest challenge that I see and many customers see is, what is your plan to really get what you need to run your business properly? I know that sounds a bit of a crazy thing for me to say, but it's not the case that the COTS packages themselves are the future necessarily. You always have this buy versus build debate within lots of companies. Each approach gives you a set of really positive things, but also some negative things. If you look at COTS, you could say you're building tomorrow's legacy because you're still beholden to a certain set of lock-ins. And if you build, then you are subject to potentially internal delays. You're really conscious of your own skill sets and ability to deliver that. And there's a lot of cost overruns associated with that. The approach that we see, and we start to see a lot more people consider this approach, is there probably is a middle ground here, which is, what data and information do you need from those COTS systems? And then what can you assemble in a separate business process that, whilst taking the appropriate amounts of data from those systems, doesn't mean that you have to spend your time then trying to navigate and transition within those systems. You're literally building on top.
But one of the changes we've seen, and this comes back to the build-it-yourself and the internal time delays, is that that build-it-yourself is no longer just about the IT department. This word democratization has been going around for the last 3 to 4 years, but instead of just being a word, it's now becoming a reality. We're devolving the data in such a way that people can utilize it. We're devolving the tools to build applications so that anybody can utilize it. But we still tend to miss the greater framework into which all this slots. When you look around your customers and you look around the projects you've been involved in, how do people best manage that citizen development stroke easy access to APIs and therefore access to data to the more controlled side of the business where it becomes business critical, mission critical services?
In some respects, it's an internal transformation that people have to go through as well, because it's quite a leap of faith to move from one to the other sometimes. What we've observed is, again, coming back to doing this in bite-sized chunks and showing those users, I use the word users because they could come from the technology function, they could come from business operations, they could come from marketing, But by giving and empowering those individuals with the ability to interrogate the data and start to see the results that that could give, creates in itself a natural bow wave of not just enthusiasm, but forward momentum to say, oh, we want more of this. We can do better things with this. That's the starting point. Because unless you can get that effect within organizations, you're always going to have a bit of a them and us. Well, you know, we'll go away and build it and come back and let you know about it in 6 months versus I'll just go and give this to someone else to do. Both of those outcomes sometimes don't have particularly good results. There is, for us, the adoption, and that's probably the best word I could use, the internal adoption of this new way of doing things is completely predicated upon people seeing the value of it very, very quickly. You can then take that and build the controls in so it does conform a little more to a standard enterprise architecture. But unless you get that upfront, yes, I can see the value of this quickly. I can see I want to know more. I want to learn more. Give me the templates. Give me the use cases. Work with me to educate my colleagues. Without that, technology for technology's sake is just not going to cut it.
But in order to give people that framework, that architecture, we need to understand the components we're building. If we go back to 1988, we started to have the conversation around the fact that we wouldn't need a lot of developers. Business analysts would come in, developers would write some blobs, and business analysts would just click this together like Lego. Well, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 generations of technology later, we're reaching the point of a composable architecture. But instead of it being business analysts doing that click together, we're actually pushing that right down to the user at the front end. But that puts a lot of pressure on how you build that architecture, puts pressure on you understanding what that architecture should be. How mature are we yet in this? Or are we finally starting to realize that idea from 88, but maybe be 1, 2, 3 revolutions away from composable being really what we need?
In many areas that we observe, we're kind of there. If I look at our own scenarios where we have off-the-shelf accelerators that in effect are pre-written code and pre-written modules, the assembly of that is a technical challenge. But the definition of what you want as a business to get to isn't. So if you're building an airport, you want to turn around your planes far faster. You want to use some form of AI to give you a more predictive and consistent turnaround time. You want some AI to probably predict footfall at certain rates because it's linked back to airport scheduling. You can and should be able to verbalize that as an organization. Where sometimes it's fallen down is the translation of that into any form of technology delivery has become complex, and in many cases that initial intent gets lost. Now you can literally be in a room and have that discussion, and in a few weeks' time you've built something where it's demonstrable. I'm sure we're no different to lots of other companies. We have over 200 of these modules. They are tried and tested, and they've been used in anger in many industries. The mixing and matching of these accelerators now enable you to then put that together with some form of clarity and surety that it's going to work, and then for the organization to build on its own special differentiation as well, which is something you don't get with an off-the-shelf standard package.
Those modules that you've got, how abstract do they become? If I look back through the multiple generations of conversation we've had over the last 20, 25 years, we've moved from the idea that a module was really just a loosely coupled framework to actually, in some cases, being much more rigid, into which we simply added the last bits that customized it for company A or company B, to a cloud world where actually this all has to be commoditized in such a way that the owner of the cloud can update those components but not break everything further down the line. Those arguably are different views on the architecture that your company is looking to build its apps on. How do we get ourselves into a stable state where we can adapt to what we want, but at the same time not have too rigid a set of components that we're building from and leave it open enough for people to add that uniqueness?
Speaking from a net company standpoint, most of the modules that we've created have been written in the technologies that you would expect. They'd leave open an open API scenario, but they are extremely well documented. They are very mature. They're not very abstract. They are modules that do a certain business function, and if one wants to create a new business function in a firm, stitching two of those together tends not to be an onerous task because the documentation is there, but the room to build on top is there also. And that happens all the time. People are continuously building on top of the accelerators that we have stitched together to enable something to happen. And you're right, you have to have that provision. The ongoing running of that on cloud or whatever else is completely up to the individual customer. Most customers, from a UK standpoint, seem to be wedded to public cloud now. That isn't necessarily the case elsewhere, though. I think the UK is quite advanced in its thinking about cloud. But that's a sort of secondary response, because clearly you get into a whole different debate about whether applications themselves are written to be running on cloud.
You talked there about OpenAPI. That raises the question of standards. People like to talk about standards until they get in the way of what they want to do. And then they write a little bit of stuff over here, they do a little bit of fiddling over there, and they fiddle with something somewhere else. And suddenly what should have been a standardized approach that you can move to where you want it is completely locked into where it is. How focused are people on making sure that when they use the idea of a standard approach, they actually stick to the idea of a standards approach?
I feel you've teed me up there for no success in how I answer that. I'm probably going to be a little contentious here, but to deliver successful transformation requires discipline. That's not, in our experience, entirely accepted or understood sometimes. Without that discipline, sometimes there are trade-offs. It's written in an open form. It's written to enable you to build on top of it. You're not going to incur license fees, but it's been written in these particular languages. That is something you have to live with. Another view is 80% of something that works is far better than 20% of something that you're constantly trying to change. I would argue discipline is hugely important, and that tinkering with things will ultimately get in the way of you delivering something successfully at an enterprise-wide level in this space anyway.
The reason I ask it is I'm old enough to remember PIC as an operating system. Its goal was portability until the system integrator teams came along and produced applications that took advantage of bells and whistles. But actually, to the end user, those bells and whistles become quite important because they're seen as the separation between us and the competition. What is it that we're doing that they can't? Why is it that people want to come to us and use what we're doing rather than go to the competition? So getting that discipline doesn't necessarily seem to be an easy thing.
It's not an easy thing at all, because the question becomes, are you going to differentiate through the technology you use? Or are you going to differentiate between the quality of the business idea or process you implement?
How much of that is cultural? Because differentiation and discipline are different sides of the same coin when we're talking about how do we make our business run more effectively, but also give us an edge against competition. But if we're not bought into that from top to bottom of the business, who should be driving that?
In the world we live in, that is the job of the senior leadership of a company.
And how often do the senior leadership get it?
In my view, increasingly they're getting it. You find more and more people getting into those positions who come from technology backgrounds. Often people still say at senior levels, I don't understand technology. It's difficult to accept that when technology is such an important part and underpins so many facets of a business. I think the question is less about the trade-offs. You can't deliver this kind of transformation without discipline. You just can't. Many people have had fantastic ideas, but they never see the light of day. And the difference between a successful firm and a not successful firm is not necessarily because they had the idea, but they executed on it. And still the biggest challenge that I see is delivering, because it's not easy.
We talk about digital transformation, but the reality is that this is not a big bang, a one done and finished. We're moving into a world now where there is no 5-year, 10-year stability of what we're doing. We are going to have to be constantly transforming in order to stay ahead. That argues for a much, much greater level of discipline than we've ever had within the way we've written software and run IT. Are people beginning to accept that this is a continuously moving footprint? Or are we still hanging on to the fact that we're going to invest this money, make this digital transformation, and set ourselves up for the next 5 years?
That's a big question. Depends how long people are listening to this have spent either trying to code these or else run an organization. Is that well understood, that it's an iterative approach? again, I think it's become increasingly understood, whether you be in the public or the private sector. It's very rare that you see the fruits of a transformation within 2 years of inception. The key is you have to get started. We still see a lot of projects that spend a huge amount in the requirements definition phase, and then suddenly, oh, we're running out of runway. We better deliver something, which makes it all a little bit too late. We're talking here about the fact that this is a continuous iteration within firms. There is no such thing as a digital transformation bang. Oh, look at me. I look totally different. And there's no better example for me from our experience of the transformation of society in places such as Scandinavia. If anyone can go and look at the UN rankings now, countries such as Denmark are now regularly voted as the top country for digitizing the delivery of public services to the citizens. I had the great pleasure the other week of meeting the lady who was the first director general for the Danish Digital Organization. She was at the heart of putting in place the plans that have ultimately led to the country hitting the top of those rankings. I can say, in all honesty, this was engineered that way. That organization was set up and it was under the Ministry of Finance, because if you control the financials, you control a lot of the direction. Nothing's changed there. But most importantly, it's been a 12-year journey, and they would say they're still only halfway through. They launched something called Digital Post, the first delivery that every citizen in the country has a digital mailbox. He or she can access every single facet of their government services through that mailbox. Tax, car tax, insurance. That digital mailbox now has the ability to link to your bank accounts. That's quite an undertaking if you think about it, especially as we live in a country that still can't deliver a single sign-on. And that's all planned. What they've done is they've built a set of platforms cross-government, which requires, one, the purse strings being in one place. Secondly, tremendous cooperation between various agencies. But because they achieved that and built those underpinning platforms, they can now build on top of them. But this has taken 12 years and will just continue to evolve as is. In the private sector too, you see companies that embarked on this 10 years ago. Capital One said, right, we're going to change the way we deliver products and services. And by the way, we're going to do it via public cloud technologies. How do you take an IT department of 5,000 people and make it a 10,000 person strong AWS trained organization? That doesn't happen easily. Those are just examples that I see, and I'm sure many listeners on the podcast will see, that these things are a continuous journey, and they need leaders who understand that and are constantly going to be pushing it, because it's hard and there is no silver bullet. And if any supplier tells you there's a silver bullet, there's probably not. And the successful approaches that you witness are almost always predicated on it just becomes a way of being. And you begin to strangle — it's a terrible word to use, but let's use it nonetheless — you're strangling those old systems and switching them off as you go. And each time you're learning and you're iterating, and the people in the organization are learning and iterating. There is no magic bullet. And in a way, the word digital transformation personally doesn't sit well with me. This is transforming your business by taking advantage of all these great digital technologies that are out there.
But how do we plan and budget this? Historically, we would come up with an idea. We'd spend a lot of time sizing systems, generally get it horribly wrong when it came to data storage and have to be continually buying extra bits in. When we come to a much more flexible, continuous change, we fall into that problem with cybersecurity. And that is, it seems to be a never-ending pit to the board. There's no actual goal at the end by which somebody can build a budget and hit key indicators to know that they've met that budget and met all the goals. If we're going to be continuously transforming, what does that mean for our budgetary and our planning processes?
At the highest level, that means that the planning processes, the life cycles, get shorter. You measure things by output and outcome rather than by some big bang. It depends how well you scope these projects, how well you measure scope creep. These things haven't changed since 20, 30 years. It's just that you're now probably introducing more complexity into the initial design, because you're probably bringing in more stakeholders, you're bringing in more options, you're bringing in new technologies. But ultimately, I don't think it fundamentally changes the acceptance that you have to measure these by outcomes. You've got to contract more for outcomes and less for year on year in budget. Less CapEx, and there's going to be a change between the CapEx, OpEx, obviously, from a budgeting standpoint.
But if we were to go through the KPIs for most organizations, outputs and outcomes make up a very small number of those KPIs when it comes to this. So how do organizations change their KPIs?
You need to be far more accurate around what it is you're trying to achieve, what it is you think you can get back. This takes us into a slightly different area, but happy to go there, around how many companies do really operate benefits realization as a discipline, because they're basically only looking at sometimes 1 or 2 years out, which isn't enough time to see whether you've got a good ROI on whatever the investments were. Where we've seen people getting much better at seeing the return on investment is where they've actually changed the way that they commercially source this stuff. We're not there yet. We're still commercially sourcing for, in effect, a one-size-fits-all.
This is where I put everybody on the spot on these podcasts. You're sat in a room. A whole bunch of people want to know, how do we bring all this together? What are the top three things they need to have in mind in order to move from that COTS-driven, static data world to a much more dynamic, continuous change?
Three things. I think the first one, and I still see it a lot, is you cannot now separate the IT organization from the rest of the business. It is the business, and therefore it is in itself just part of the answer. So internal alignment around this is more crucial now than it's ever been. You can't adopt the old supplier approach of, here we go, I'll take your requirements, I'll build you something, and I'll come back and see if it works. The alignment is key. The business unit heads are sitting down with their IT teams. I do think there needs to be an acceleration of the change organizationally in terms of how technology gets delivered. Secondly is, and I think we've touched on it on the podcast, this is a continuous journey. This is not something great is going to happen in 18 months and we flick a switch and the world changes dramatically for us. Thirdly, and it probably is aligned to the second factor, this isn't about technology ultimately. There are technologies being invented every single day of the week. But if they can't be landed in a way that makes sense to the organization, then they will just be technologies.
It's interesting. We often get transfixed by the glamour of a new technology coming along before we've even understood the technology before that, and even the technology before that or the one before that.
Some companies and some industries have moved far faster because they have seen how their industry is going to be disrupted by technology. If you went to an investment bank, it would be rare that you didn't find the technology people in an investment bank sitting right next to traders. And in many cases, the two are so inextricably linked nowadays. You don't have great data sets and you have the incumbent AI and so on and so forth built into what you're trading. You could arguably say you've already lost. But there's other industries a bit behind the curve. They're not as impacted by it because of regulation and whatever else, and probably got a little more time. But ultimately, for me, everything will be underpinned and driven and changed by some form of technology. But it's not understanding the technology per se. It's understanding what to do with it.
I think that's a really interesting shift. Richard, thank you for talking with me today.
No worries. It's an absolute pleasure.